Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com. Spout presents Butterknife, a new generation detective series made by a new generation of filmmakers. Find out more at butterknife.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. On this week's show, the Oscars and sex. The Onion AV Club's Keith Phipps will join us to discuss who will win, and more importantly, who should win this year's top Oscars. And then Maddie and I will slip into something more comfortable in honor of Valentine's Day for a countdown of our top five love scenes.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by the Rosebuds, and a brief review of last year's Palme d'Or winner at the Cannes Film Festival. 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
But first, a little sightseeing with a couple of hitmen, Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell, in Bruges.
What is it you've done, Raymond?
Murder, father.
Why did you murder someone, Raymond?
For money.
Who did you murder for money, Raymond?
You, father. After I killed them, I walked home to await instructions. Get to Bruges.
Bruges, Bruges.
Bruges? Where's that?
It's in Belgium.
For 2 weeks, in Bruges, in a room like this, with you? No way.
Been to the top of the tower? Guidebook says it's a must-see.
Well, you ain't going up there.
Why?
It's all windy stairs. I'm not being funny.
What exactly are you trying to say?
They're a bunch of elephants.
Mr. Kempinar, I was supposed to interview Martin McDonagh, director and writer of the new film In Bruges, and I was really looking forward to it. McDonagh is one of my favorite playwrights. Tony-nominated author of The Lieutenant of Inishmore, The Beauty Queen of Lenine, The Pillow Man, and many, many more. But due to some scheduling conflicts on my part, I wasn't able to do the interview. But in anticipation of the interview, I put together a list of questions. And one of them came from my friend, a New York-based actor named Andy Grote-Lucien. You would recognize him from the Peyton Manning Visa commercials.
Of course.
He's going to kill me for mentioning those. And in Mr. McDonagh's absence, I'm actually going to ask you one of those questions. Can you do an Irish-English accent?
You do not want to hear that.
Okay. Well, for my money, Mr. McDonagh and Steppenwolf's own Tracy Letts are probably the two best playwrights writing today at incorporating violence into their work for the stage. Film, however, as we know, is a completely different beast, and the shock value of violence is somewhat lessened because, I mean, we've seen it all. And if we haven't seen it all, it's probably coming out in the next Dario Argento film. So I want to ask you here, in Bruges, does McDonagh employ violence effectively, and to what, if any, end?
I'm not sure about what end. The issue of violence in the film is one I have to admit I haven't given a lot of thought to. I'm not sure that he's doing anything new or creative or original with the way violence is used in the film. I will actually say that I know one of the violent scenes in the film is one of the scenes I had a problem with. I think when you get to the end of the film, I'm not going to give anything away, but in trying to make everything tie together thematically, I think there's a certain glibness to the way he deals with life and death, and something happens to a minor character. Again, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it really bothered me, and not because I became really attached to that character, but because it just happened for no other reason than for McDonagh to have some nice symmetry to the story. And, you know, you think about a movie like Pulp Fiction, which a lot of people have talked about that movie with regard to In Bruges as well, dealing with hitmen and the ultra-hip dialogue and whatnot. Mm-hmm. In Pulp Fiction, Tarantino certainly doesn't care about the movie's body count. That movie, though, never asks us to really see death as potentially tragic or sad. This movie otherwise does. There is a moral conflict going on. We're supposed to see the seriousness of life and death. When you get to the end, then, and have the bit of violence that we see and the way it plays out, that did bother me.
Yeah, I couldn't disagree with you more.
Really?
I think it's absolutely beautifully done. I loved, loved, loved this film.
No kidding.
This is my favorite film of the year, hands down. And you know what? Hearing your comments, I hate to hedge this. This film is going to divide people.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. I can't recommend it for everyone. It employs moments of very graphic violence. The dialogue is, I think, deliciously and pointedly offensive.
It is.
But the big reason that I love this film is the reason that actually you sort of touched on that you didn't like it. It is impeccably, impeccably structured.
Mm-hmm.
And that's his playwriting background. Every scene, every line, no matter how outrageous, moves the plot forward. And you notice that. Everything comes full circle, which is an amazing achievement when you think of how irreverent a lot of the dialogue seems to be. And oftentimes, really well-structured films, I'm thinking of Mamet's film work, I'm also thinking of a film like Fargo from the Coen brothers, they get accused of using their characters as nothing more than plot devices. I think that's ridiculous. I don't buy the argument for a second. And here, the surprising strength of this film is the depth of these characters. Brendan Gleeson is just a teddy bear of a hitman.
Uh-huh.
And I think we should set up the plot a little bit. Basically, it's two hitmen that are sent to cool off in Bruges, this town in
Belgium.
Wait
for their next assignment
exactly.
from their boss.
And the amount of empathy that you have for Gleeson at the end of the film is just absolutely remarkable. But for me, the real find was Colin Farrell. And I remember watching Joel Schumacher's Tigerland, and you know, way back in 2000, being bowled over by how good this guy was.
I loved him in
that, too. Yeah, and I wasn't a big fan of the film.
No.
And,
it's okay. I like it, though.
And if you look at his filmography since then, he really has sort of kind of fallen off the map for me. You look at Alexander, The Phone Booth.
Yeah.
What else is
It's not pretty, really.
No, it really isn't. I mean, The New World with Terrence Malick. But I've never seen him do comedy before, and he has this really sort of Herculean task with this role, and he nails it exactly.
Yeah.
He's playing a hitman from a lower-class background, and he's got these prejudices that, you know, sort of stem from his own ignorance of the world. And for example, he has this fascination with little people, and he delivers several really cruel, ugly lines at the expense of Jordan Prentice, who's a dwarf actor. And Farrell plays it as earnestly as possible, and that's the only thing you can do. If for one moment, we don't believe any of his in Bruges comments,
right,
then the whole thing is going to fall apart, and that earnestness isn't going to come through, and it's just going to become a succession of cruel jokes.
Yeah, I like this film too, actually, and other than maybe some shortcomings at the end of the film, I really did enjoy it. As a buddy movie, it works, as this movie about two characters trying to redeem themselves morally. I think it absolutely works. And I'm really glad to hear you say what you're saying about Colin Farrell, because I thought maybe I was crazy here. I think he's really brilliant
in this
film. And
he's
you're right.
Brilliant.
I've never really liked him. Even in The New World, which is a Malick film I like, I don't think he's particularly good in it. Mm-hmm. I did like him in Tigerland, and I do like that film. But other than that, I've never been impressed with him. And here, I really thought he was a discovery. These are two characters who obviously like each other, they look out for each other, but they are completely different. And that dichotomy that Martin McDonagh explores is really fun to watch. Gleason's the laid-back, more intellectual one who wants to enjoy the sights of Bruges. And Farrell, he's this more neurotic character and a little more hedonistic. He wants to just hang out in the pub. But
yeah.
I've never seen Colin Farrell play comedy and play neurotic before. And it's really interesting. He's actually more of a Woody Allen character in this film than he is in Cassandra's Dream.
That's a good point.
Which is sort of ironic. But their dynamic, the rhythm of their dialogue in most scenes is really great. With Gleason, he's like the father with his impetuous son, who he's always trying to keep in line. And I think they just pull that off really well here.
We're staying in tonight. Whatever happens.
Except what? Except only one of us needs to stay in. Really?
Which one of us would that be now, Ray? I thought you didn't like Bruce.
I don't like Bruce at all. But I did already say I had a date with a Belgian lady. The Belgian film business, which I did already say about before.
I just don't get into any trouble. We're keeping a low profile.
I think it works in having Bruges standing in perfectly for purgatory. That's basically the concept of this film, is that you've got these two characters looking for redemption, and Bruges is this place that's caught between the modern world and the medieval age, mostly medieval, and you've got these two characters who are stuck in their own limbo, literally in that they have to sit around waiting for instruction from Harry, their boss, on what to do next, but then figuratively in that they are conflicted about some of the things they obviously have done or have to do. So I think the concept of it's great, and the fact is, I just thought it was a really funny, dark comedy.
The writing is brilliant and so clever and so funny. I laughed all the way through this film, and the humor in this film is right up my alley. I mean, it's the way I deal personally with the human condition. I just love to laugh at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually one of the things I miss moving from New York to Chicago, is that stand-up comedy scene. And let's be clear here, this is dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't obscene sort of shock value comedy. There is irony here,
yeah.
Really subtle irony at work, and you touched on it there. And I love, and you're right, I love the situation. What happens when two hitmen are sent to a medieval town to cool off?
Right.
And of course, you've got Gleason, who does exactly what I would do. He gets a guidebook and he tours the local sites. And I used to do that all the time. I'm a history buff. I did it in college, much to the annoyance of my friends. We're going to Key West for spring break. Great. I would make itineraries for the
see
trip.
See the treasure.
Yeah. Yeah, we'd have to go see the Hemingway
hunts.
House.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, or it'd be like you and I mm-hmm. going to In Bruges.
Sure.
I just love every single scene between Gleason and Farrell. Really, really works, and
yeah.
It's so smart.
Yeah,
it
wasn't
really, really
for
smart.
Their performances and the rhythm of their dialogue, really, they make it all work. And I also will say that I think it's unfortunate that the advertising gives away who Harry is. I mean, we all know Ralph Fiennes is in this movie.
Yeah.
When I saw this film at Sundance, I went to the opening night premiere. It did open the festival. And McDonough has talked about how basically this is kind of Waiting for Godot, except Godot actually shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Ralph Fiennes as the boss. And I love the fact that throughout the whole film, I just got to hear this really loathsome character mm-hmm. on the other end of the phone, obviously rich, but with this really unabashed Cockney accent, and not being able to place it. I had no idea who it was, and so there was this great mystery of who is this character. And then when Ralph Fiennes shows up at the end, who I always think of as so prim and proper, it was just a real jolt. It was another kick that made the film really work. And then at the end, he's only in the movie for about 10 or 15 minutes, but he just revels in the role. I thought
he
was a blast.
So much fun.
But I think it's more fun not knowing that he's coming.
You know, my only quibble, I do have a couple quibbles, and they mainly surround the Harry character. One of the things, everybody's motivation is really, really defined in this film, except for Harry's. He has this sort of talk about honor and code that's driving him.
Yeah.
And I just wanted a little bit more clarification. Raise the stakes for him just a little bit.
Sure.
And there is a final shootout between these two characters, and I thought the dialogue, for the only time it pulled me out, I noticed it.
Really?
Yeah, it was the only time I'm like, okay, that might just be just a little silly.
But that's really funny, because I made a note of that same scene, and I'm not surprised it pulled you out, because I think that's what McDonough is trying to do there.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually acknowledging there that, hey, this is a hitman movie. We've all seen these hitman
yeah.
movies a million times, so I'm going to have Farrell and Fiennes do this thing where they decide the terms of their shootout in a way that completely deflates what we're usually,
mm-hmm.
what we're accustomed to seeing in a climactic shootout. It totally subverts that, and I love that,
yeah,
of course.
And I really like his filmmaking here, too. It's really, really sharp. I mean, he just tells a clear story.
Yeah.
He doesn't get really fancy. I like the one little, you're big on homages. There's one little
sure.
homage to the Coen brothers there at the end. I'm thinking about the staircase leading up to the bell tower where
yeah.
they sort of slowly track up. I caught that. I really, really liked it.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of nice touches. I will say, it's a playwright's movie, as you touched on, because the writing is the dominant thing here.
It's
yeah, it's brilliant.
Brilliant
in a lot of scenes, not in every scene. And there are some scenes where, from a filmmaking point of view, they just sort of lay there visually,
no,
I think. And there's an awkwardness
everything
to the
is used,
to the
everything
editing.
Moves this film forward. That's the beauty.
Okay, well, Maddie loves In Bruges. I liked In Bruges. It's out now in theaters, as well as 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, a film set in communist Romania, kind of the final stages of the Ceausescu era, and very explicitly deals with two women, one who is going about having an abortion mm-hmm. and her friend who has to make a lot of sacrifices to get it done. It's about 113 minutes long, I think, and plays out almost in real time
yeah.
with a lot of long still takes, the camera capturing life. And you've heard Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and myself talk about this movie on our Top 10 Films of the Year show. Michael Phillips, it was his number 3 movie of the year, but he described it as grueling. I talked about it being almost oppressive in its heaviness. I wanted several times to stop the film. I wonder if you had a similarly challenging experience, but a rewarding one, as we did, and do you see what all the fuss is about after this movie failed to get the Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language Film?
Yeah, this film would have been on my Top 10 of the year. Yes, you're right. It's a hard film to discuss, but thankfully for me, it wasn't a hard movie to watch at all.
Really?
And it easily could have been. Again, the brilliance of this film, like In Bruges, is it's in its ability to show, not to tell. And this film could have told me how I need to feel. You know, here's this woman in this situation. Ceausescu's Romania. She's pregnant. Here's how you're supposed to feel about that situation. No.
No.
The brilliance of it is that we have to watch these women basically take this challenge head on. And my favorite scene is when the girl who's helping her friend have the abortion goes to her boyfriend's house.
Yes.
That is my favorite scene because here her boyfriend is from a different class, sort of the academic medical profession, and you have all these elitist people sitting around talking about theories, and they're so enlightened.
While her
and
friend is back at the hotel.
And here's this woman. She just has to sit there. Here's a woman who's actually dealing with life and death right there, and the camera just stays on her. Stays
That's
on her
the
entire time.
Of it.
It's just absolutely brilliant as this sort of Alice in Wonderland Mad Hatter Tea Party plays out. Brilliant film.
Yeah, the director, Christian Mungiu, he really does use the long take there and throughout the film to perfection. It's hard to watch because those long takes, though, they serve that purpose. You're right. That's the scene I also wanted to single out where not only is it capturing the mundane aspects of life in Ceausescu's Romania and how this procedure fits into that, but he puts us in that same position as the characters. And you mentioned Anna Maria Marinka, the actress as Otilia. She has to go to her boyfriend's house for dinner and sit there and listen to this bourgeois babble, and the whole time with the camera just lingering on her in desperation, she's clearly thinking about her friend, and we're sitting there the whole time thinking about her friend and what could possibly be going on back at the hotel. She's just had an abortion. This same friend has shown that she can't follow directions very well, and she has a lot of tasks that she has to carry out in order for everything to go okay. And so that frustration, that desperation that she feels is exactly what we feel. What could possibly be going on back there? And yet we're stuck here with her. It really is brilliant. And you're absolutely right about its politics. Mungiu has talked about the fact that he's not willing to necessarily say, this is where I fall on the abortion issue. And this has been a year of abortion films or movies that deal with unwanted pregnancies, Knocked Up, Juno, Lake of Fire, the Tony Kaye documentary. And there's a lot of disagreement about Tony Kaye and what his perspective is in that film, Lake of Fire, how biased he is. But I don't think there's a whole lot of politics going on in Juno or Knocked Up. The fact is, if they have abortions, there's no movie, so the story kind of needs it. But here, I do love the fact that there is nothing judgmental about it. It is simply capturing life, and this is a fact of life at this time. And whether it's right or wrong, it's left up to us to decide.
You're exactly right. It's a great journey story. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just beautiful.
Yeah, I wondered if you would like it, too, because you have proven here recently that you're a real documentary guy, and this movie, of course, plays out like a documentary in a scary way where it is, as we said, just capturing life. Real quick before we close, though, we have to mention Vlad Ivanov, the abortionist.
Man, he's perfect.
How did I leave him off my villains list when we did our 2007 blowout? I mean, he's brilliant because he is the villain, and yet at the same time, he's just a guy out to make a buck, and he knows how to do his
helping.
Job. And
he's helping.
They need him. That's the conflict here that's so amazing to watch. The way he uses everything the girls say and do to his advantage. He turns it into leverage so that he can get from them exactly what he wants, and he's in control the entire time. It's really brilliant stuff. So, again, In Bruges in 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days are in theaters now in limited release. And if you've seen either movie and agree or disagree with our take, send us an email or a short MP3 clip, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. As far as top five London films go, no blow up? No surreal images of London's mod and swinger cultures complete with a performance from the Yardbirds and a strange threesome? Your feedback is next. Stay with us.
Hey, Adam and Maddie, this is Zach from Atlanta, Georgia. Just wanted to put my two cents in with your top five London films. My favorite London film is the 1980 John McKenzie film, The Long Good Friday. Stars Bob Hoskins, and he is outstanding as a wealthy London gangster at war with the IRA and also with the people who are supposed to be on his side. Just a great film. My favorite London film, just some great shots of London as well.
Maddie and Adam, this is Scott in L.A. I never thought that I would be calling in to leave you guys a voice message, but after listening to you guys' top five London films, I just felt absolutely compelled to call in and find out how on earth both of you cats went through top five lists with honorable mentions and ties and the whole nine, and neither of you mentioned Stephen Frears' Dirty Pretty Things. How is that possible?
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Alongside Maddie Robinson, I am Adam Kempinar. A couple of voicemails there from Zach and Scott wanting to know where was The Long Good Friday and where was Dirty Pretty Things on our list of top five London movies. Maddie, your excuse.
I am telling you, this is the week where my film ignorance really came to light. I just haven't seen these films.
No.
Long Good Friday sounds right up my
alley. Yeah, Bob Hoskins.
I put it right on my Netflix queue, and I've never seen Dirty Pretty Things.
No, I haven't either, even though it is Stephen Frears, who directed My Beautiful Laundrette, and Rory in Chicago also left us a voicemail about this. I like Stephen Frears a lot, but Dirty Pretty Things, for whatever reason, is a movie I haven't caught up with. Audrey Tautou from Amelie is very good. Chiwetel Ejiofor is in it. I love both of them.
Yeah.
But I have never caught up with the film. It came out, I think, in 2002, which we were not doing film spotting in 2002, so I was not seeing as many movies as I obviously do now. We need to catch up with it. And those films for us very well could end up being film spotting discoveries, movies that we may not have otherwise seen if it wasn't for this show, which segues perfectly
into... Did you major in segueing?
I majored in segues. Thank you very much. We are going to have our 200th episode coming up here in a couple weeks, and we want you to send us your film spotting discoveries, movies that you don't think you would have seen and ended up loving if it wasn't for this show. Maddie, we've already received maybe 6 or 7 great voicemails on it, so feel free to send us your feedback via email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or by voicemail, 206-203-2463. And after our special 200th episode of the show, we are planning to take a week off.
Oh, thank goodness.
I know, something we do not do very often here in the past 3 years. We are going to have a little break. We will post, though, a Best of Film Spotting show, replay some of our favorite interviews from the year, so you can look forward to that. We also wanted to mention something coming up that we're very excited about here in April for those of you who are in the Chicago area. Maddie and I teaching a course, the University of Chicago's Graham School.
Wow.
Yeah,
pigs,
we are.
Pigs are flying.
I know. We are teaching a course on Howard Hawks and Michael Curtiz. Are you ready, Mr. Professor?
I'm working on my Garrison Keillor voice.
Do you have your tweed jackets out?
I've already got it. With the patches.
Yeah. It's going to be a good time. If you want more information about that class, you don't have to be a University of Chicago student to take it. If you want more information, learn more at filmspotting.net. Let's get into our poll questions then for... Last week, we asked you, actually, we did some housekeeping. We wanted your help in deciding what next marathon we should do. Ingmar Bergman is our current marathon. We were hoping to discuss Fanny and Alexander this week, but decided to put it off when we realized we really need to get our Oscar picks in. So look for that next week. After Bergman, though, what should be our next marathon? We gave you 3 options: Pedro Almodovar, Angry Young Men, Lindsay Anderson and Tony Richardson, their movies, or Blaxploitation. Maddie, what are we doing?
The people have spoken, and we are going to be doing a Pedro Almodovar marathon.
Wonderful.
He won with 43%, Blaxploitation a close second at 33%, Angry Young Men garnering 24%.
And eventually we hope to get to all 3 of these marathons, but it does look like Almodovar is next. And I do want to throw this out there right now because I know we have a lot of pronunciation Nazis in our listening audience.
What is it, Pedro?
No, Almodovar. Nicely done, though, Maddie. I've heard a lot of people call him Almodovar. I've always said Almodovar. I want to know what is correct. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Yeah, don't look at me.
Don't look at Maddie. I'm not. Okay, the Oscar for Best Picture. That's our poll question for this week. Obviously, we are going to make our Oscar picks here in the next segment coming up on Sunday, February 24th. We simply want to know what movie you think should win. So the Oscar for Best Picture should go to...
Your choices are Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, or There Will Be Blood.
We will hold off on making our picks. You will hear those here coming up in the next segment, but we do want to know what you think. Go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. Before we get into feedback here, Maddie, we are going to do our top 5 London movies feedback. Got a lot of great responses, a lot of listeners in London or people who have spent time there or just simply love London movies. We do want to share Maddie's Movie Minute. It's a new segment.
Maddie's Movie Minute.
I don't know if it's going to be a recurring one. We'll see how it goes. You saw 3 movies last weekend. A Busy Little Boy. The Counterfeiters was one of them, an Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Language Film. We're not going to mention that here now because we may review it here on an upcoming show. But you also saw Vince Vaughn's Wild West comedy show and the Alex Gibney documentary, Taxi to the Dark Side. Maddie's Movie Minute starts now.
All right. I love stand-up comedy. I was really looking forward to this film, this Vince Vaughn film, because it featured Ahmed Ahmed, a comic I really respect. The premise, really simple. 2005, Vince Vaughn took 4 comics on the road for a tour, 30 cities in 30 nights. Unfortunately, though, most of the behind-scenes stuff really isn't all that engrossing, but the most disappointing aspect is that the onstage stuff isn't all that great either.
No?
Except for one great bit. Brett Ernst has this one great bit about roller skating, and Justin Long, our friend Justin Long,
yeah,
does a spot-on Vince Vaughn send-up. But beyond that, not enough to recommend seeing it. However, I do. Maddie's Movie Minute does recommend Taxi to the Dark Side. My God, this is a fantastic film. It's just this heart-wrenching account of the story. An Afghani taxi driver fingered as a terrorist who dies under torture from American forces. Gibney then opens it up and examines Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, interviewing soldiers who were posted there. It really is an indictment of torture. This film is meticulously researched.
Obviously a topic very much in the news right now. I do look forward to seeing that film. I saw Alex Gibney's documentary Gonzo out at Sundance. He's the one who directed the Hunter S. Thompson documentary. A good movie, not a great one. I've heard good things, though, and now here you are saying many good things as well.
Rush out to see it if it is playing near you. Also, Maddie's Movie Minute would like to comment on the passing of actor Roy Scheider. Passed away this past Sunday at age 75, of course, best known for The French Connection, Jaws, 2010, The Year We Make Contact, and All That Jazz.
Movie I love.
Your favorite.
Joe Gideon.
But for me, Mr. Scheider will always be Billy Young from Disney's made-for-TV film, Tiger Town.
Nice.
I love that film.
Wow.
I really do. And it's
know that.
He's playing this aging, you know, baseball player. And I feel like I lost my hero a
You know
little
what?
Bit.
I know it. He's a pitcher, isn't he, in that movie or not?
No, he's a hitter.
No, you know what? I have seen that, though. I remember there's something about a kid who comes at the end. He gets into Tiger Stadium, watches Billy hit.
Yeah.
You're right. Okay, well, I'm going to have to go down nostalgia lane here and check that movie out again. We did get a lot of great London movies feedback. It was our top five last week, tying in with our review of Woody Allen's Cassandra's Dream. And we did also get some good feedback on Cassandra's Dream, but I think we should just jump into the top five lists here, like this one. Luke Allison in St. Paul, Minnesota says, as far as top five London films go, no blow up. No surreal images of London's mod and swinger cultures, complete with a performance from the Yardbirds and a strange threesome. There's nothing else like it, and I have a feeling it informed a lot of young people's opinions of the city, however fallaciously, for years to come. Other than that, I'd have to say my other four would be All or Nothing, Mike Leigh at his bleakest and brightest, showing working-class London, Murder by Decree, the quintessential Jack the Ripper film, Croupier, for all the reasons you already stated on your list, Maddie. And he says, I like the 28 Days Later, 28 Weeks Later tie. I'd say Days shows off the city more. So many memorable set pieces, including the church, the fountain with all the flyers on it, etc. But Weeks is my personal favorite. So he actually liked that movie better than Danny Boyle's original. Blow Up is a great film from Antonioni, a movie that I almost paired with Repulsion because it's both swinging 60s film. I did call my list the Blow Up Memorial List. You can see it on our top five page. I forgot to mention that. So a great choice. And I also like All or Nothing quite a bit, a movie I saw with Sam actually at the Chicago International Film Festival about 5 years ago. A good Mike Leigh film. Some great choices there from Luke.
Okay, well, Adrian Hitchcock from London actually writes in and says, Adam, after hearing of your fondness for housing problems, I have to chime in with my own favorite wartime London short, Listen to Britain, from 1942. If you saw housing problems at university, surely they showed you Listen to Britain. About 50% of it is shot in London, so I think it qualifies. It's a beautiful piece of why we fight propaganda, and without the authoritative tub-thumping voiceover. In its place, you have an 18-minute collage of virtually dialogue-less vignettes of life, work, and leisure going on under the shadow of war, all linked together by the music and sounds found or broadcast in each locale. Directed by Humphrey Jennings and Stuart McAllister, it's inspirational, sublime, poetic cinema, and it's available as an extra on Criterion's A Canterbury Tale DVD.
They actually did show me Listen to Britain along with Housing Problems at university, and I guess we should actually say vignettes of life, work, and leisure. Correct, Maddie?
Oh, right. Very leisure. Nice. Very nice.
Yeah, thank you. I'm trying to pay tribute there to Adrian and our London listeners. But it is actually Listen to Britain, a fantastic film. Humphrey Jennings is one of the godfathers of documentary. Stephen Alford in Austin, Texas says, Maddie, you don't have to defend yourself for liking Sliding Doors.
Stephen, quiet.
I was surprised at how well it worked. Also, did you like About a Boy? That was set in London, wasn't it? I love About a Boy, the Nick Hornby adaptation with Hugh Grant. You fell asleep during it.
I did. Yeah. I did. I don't remember that much about it.
Okay, well, let's get to one of your countrymen, Martin from Stockholm, Sweden.
He says, having lived in London for 4 years as a kid, I've always loved London. I agree with Maddie in that I'm sort of looking for a postcard picture of the city in a film. I don't really feel that your picks lived up to that. I would have liked to have seen, for example, Mike Nichols' 2004 film Closer in there, or Breaking and Entering, another Jude Law flick. The Nick Hornby adaptation About a Boy is another great London movie. I'd probably put that at the top of my list. Also, an honorable mention to Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Nothing says postcard like East End Gangsters.
Very well put. I actually did consider an East End gangster movie for my list, The Craze. I do like About a Boy, as we mentioned, and I am a big fan of Closer. Sam notoriously hated that film.
It's a terrible film. It's a terrible film. It's a terrible play.
Well,
even more damning.
I like the acting in it. I like the
you
writing.
Do?
Oh, I do.
Oh, it's
I have
obnoxious.
Fun with those bad people
Are
in
you
that
kidding
film.
Me?
No, I really like it.
Well, I don't mind bad people
no,
having a good time, but geez, it's just
no,
terrible.
No, I have a good time watching those really just vile characters on screen for some reason in that particular film. David Lannan in Larkspur, California. Your criteria for the London Top 5 movies was described as a postcard of a city like Blues Brothers in Chicago. A Hard Day's Night is considered one of the best musical comedies of all time and is often credited with inventing the music video. Every single scene is a travelogue of London, from running down Charlotte Street chased by thousands of screaming girls, to the Marylebone tube stop, to the Hammersmith Odeon Theater, Ringo walking on the banks of the Thames River, to taking off in a helicopter from Gatwick Airport. The Mop Top should be number one on your list. I suggest you get back, and make your list again. Love the show,
man,
that
I just,
from
I
David.
I completely forgot about
Me too.
It. I just completely forgot about
and
it.
And he's absolutely right. It really should have been on the list, or at least the Hard Day's Night memorial list. A great, great choice.
Okay, well, Ben in London writes, after hearing Maddie cite Mary Poppins in his honorable mentions, I thought it was a sure thing that at least one of you would mention another great musical, the multi-Oscar-winning My Fair Lady. I know none of the film was actually shot in London, but surely the subject matter qualifies it as a London movie. Eliza Doolittle is the quintessential Londoner, and one of the main themes of the story is something that you guys even touched on earlier in the show, the significance of the class system in Britain and the effort of the working class man to climb his way to the top. Love the show. Never miss it.
Thank you, Ben, for that. And I have to confess here, Maddie, we did a musicals marathon many moons ago here on Film Spotting because I have always, for whatever reason, seem to missed musicals. I've avoided them. I've never seen My Fair Lady.
You've never seen
No.
My Fair Lady?
No.
Wow. Then how do you get... I mean, every single movie parodies this thing. Unreal. And the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain.
I think I get the references because I've seen enough of it, but never start to finish taking in the whole film.
What about Pygmalion? You've seen that?
No, I have not.
The play?
Let's move on.
George Bernard Shaw?
Let's move on.
Jeez.
I think we should move on.
Ignorant little bugger.
I know. Let's close out with this one from Caroline. I love your top 10 films set in London. I'm an American writer who's been living in London for the past 20 years, and I love this city. Any film I see set in London automatically gets an extra star. So here are my top five. She Has About a Boy.
Again.
Hugh Grant at his best. Number four, Love Actually. 10 romantic comedies for the price of one, all set in London. Number three, Austin Powers. This one did come up a few times. Number two, Match Point. Woody loves London, and it shows. I am a big fan of that film. And number one, Children of Men, my favorite film of 2006, Caroline writes. Although it's set in the future, it is frighteningly plausible. I love the image of the inflatable pig floating over the Battersea Power Station, stolen from Pink Floyd, of course, zebras on Pall Mall, exploding Starbucks, and lots of other fun touches. And Caroline also notes that she has a friend who wrote a book listing over 1,000 movies set in London. His name is Simon James. We'll put a link to that on our site, filmspotting.net, in our show notes if you want to check that one out. It's the London Film Location Guide. I think, Maddie, when you finally do get to London, you may have to check that one out and make sure you have your little walking tours all set up.
Very, very cool.
Okay, well, as always, we appreciate all the great feedback. I mean, we didn't even get to the email I really wanted to from Sean here in Chicago, who broke down his top 25 London movies into five different categories. I'm sorry, Sean, we don't have time. But if you do have any feedback for us, as always, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater and Adam and I pick this year's Oscar winners with help from The Onion's Keith Phipps. Stay with us.
When they talk, her eyes were wild, as a wild cat's in the night. She seemed her press for air, so we calmed and smoothed her hair. They sat under a carport light, then they kissed and held each other tight.
Hey, I'm Ellen Page.
And I'm Diablo Cody.
We are the actor and writer of the film Juno, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
You English, you think you're so superior, don't you? Well, you're the filth of the planet. A bunch of pompous, badly dressed, poverty-stricken, sexually repressed football hooligans. Goodbye, Archie.
Well, at least we're not irretrievably vulgar.
You know your problem? You don't like winners.
Winners?
Yeah. Winners.
Winners like North Vietnam?
Shut up! We did not lose Vietnam. It was a tie.
I'm telling you, baby, they kicked a little ass there. Boy, they whooped your hide real good.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a shot at winning a free DVD. Now, last week, we massacred the scene you just heard with Kevin Kline and John Cleese, and we really did massacre it.
Oh, yes.
From A Fish Called Wanda, a tie-in, of course, with our top five London movies.
For maybe at least the third week in a row, another eminently quotable film, Don't Call Me Stupid. Sing it. Sing it. Some great lines.
Ken is coming to kill me.
Yeah, I didn't want to do it. Many of our listeners did go down that path, but we wanted to choose a Michael Palin, Kevin Kline scene. Thought maybe going the stuttering route wasn't the right way to go.
Well, it's also just a dead giveaway.
Exactly. But A Fish Called Wanda, really one of my all-time favorite comedies. Had to go with it.
Okay, Adam. Well, reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Randall McGavick from Amarillo, Texas.
Oh, I know where Amarillo is. It's up by Lubbock and Midland.
It's
near Oklahoma.
Not near Pennsylvania or New York?
No,
okay.
That's Jersey.
Uh-huh.
Thanks.
Congratulations. Randall, email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
The other day, when I heard Mr. Fabian tell Miss Channing that her understudy was going to have a baby, and they'd have to replace her.
And you want to be Margaret's new understudy?
I don't let myself think about it.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and it ties in with our top five theme this week,
Adam.
Love scenes.
Adam.
I don't know that that's going to give it away to anyone.
Hopefully
no,
I'm working on it.
You're trying to get the voice there,
yeah.
I understand. Okay, well, you started off. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
And action.
You went to Blank's hotel this morning and talked to the desk clerk.
How do you know that?
Because I had you followed.
You had me followed?
Okay. I'm sorry, all right? I owe you an apology. This was for your own good, believe me. I know what the desk clerk told you, but what he didn't tell you is all they did was put Blank on a plane to Seattle. By now, he's probably back with his family.
The clerk said he had a bruise on his face.
Okay, he had a bruise on his face. That's a hell of a lot less than he deserves. I don't think you realize the kind of trouble you were in last night. Who do you think those people were? Those were not just ordinary people there. If I told you their names, I'm not going to tell you their names. But if I did, I don't think you'd sleep so well.
And scene. All right, if you know what film we just absolutely massacred, send us an email with your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, February 20th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
You need to talk to me.
I don't need to talk to you.
I think you do. Do you know where I'm going?
Why would I care where you're going?
I know where you are.
Yeah, where am I?
You're in the hospital across the river, but that's not where I'm going.
I'm not the president. I'm just a storyteller, man. That's all I am.
Well, I presume at the very least that you care something about what you sing every night.
Are you... How can I answer that if you got the nerve to ask me?
Javier Bardem from No Country for Old Men, and of course the great Cate Blanchett from I'm Not There, doing her Bob Dylan, a little Best Supporting Actor, Actress montage, if you will, as we transition into our Oscar picks. We're going to tell you who will win the big categories, who should win, of course, more importantly, and we're very pleased to welcome in from the AV Club, the entertainment section of The Onion. You can learn more at avclub.com. Keith Phipps. Keith, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We have had your colleague, Scott Tobias, on the show before, and we do look forward to having him back on. But we wanted to bring you in, varied up a little bit, and get into our Oscar picks. I don't know, are you excited about the Oscars? Do you get pumped up about the Oscars or not?
I used to. I kind of forget about it now. And I, when I do think about it, I realize how little I remember from year to year.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like today we were talking on The Office, like whether or not Fargo won Best Picture. It didn't. But we had to look it up, you know?
There you go.
You kind of forget these things fairly quickly.
They do all start to blend together a little bit. But you heard there, the Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress may be the leading contenders, and we're going to find out if we do think that Bardem and Blanchett have the best shots here. Let's start with Best Supporting actor, actually. The nominees: Casey Affleck in The Assassination of Jesse James, Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men, Philip Seymour Hoffman in Charlie Wilson's War, Hal Holbrook in Into the Wild, and Tom Wilkinson in Michael Clayton. Maddie, Keith, who do you think will win?
Well, I think Javier Bardem is going to win, and I think he probably should win.
Okay. Keith?
I agree it's going to be Bardem, and I think, and one thing about the Oscars this year is there are not a lot of weak choices. There aren't a lot of things that make me cringe, and this category especially, anyone could win, and it would make me happy.
I just don't want Wilkinson to win.
Me too.
Well, I'd like to see Holbrook get it. Yeah. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm with you. I think that Javier Bardem is the favorite here, and since I did think he put in the Best Supporting Actor performance of the year, I think we both had him at number one. Maddie, here, I hope that he does win as well. But if Hal Holbrook wins, I think that'd be great. And I'm actually surprised that he's not getting any more buzz than he is. Maybe it's because they already did the Lifetime Achievement thing last year with Alan Arkin. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I thought Holbrook would really be a shoe-in this year, and
yeah,
he's not getting a lot of love.
But look at that performance he's up against. I mean, it's an all-world performance, Anton Chigurh, Javier Bardem.
So. And No Country for Old Men is kind of the juggernaut here, so we're all in agreement there. Did you weigh in on who you think should win?
I mean, Holbrook will be great. Bardem will be great. I actually don't understand the hostility towards Wilkinson. I really liked him in that movie, but I'd like to see Casey Affleck recognized at some point. I mean, he's got many years to come, but he gave two great performances this year, and this is one of them.
Yeah, he was very good. Let's move on then to Best Supporting Actress: Cate Blanchett in I'm Not There, Ruby Dee in American Gangster, Saoirse Ronan in Atonement, Amy Ryan in Gone Baby Gone, and Tilda Swinton for Michael Clayton. Maddie,
I think Ruby Dee's going to win it.
You do?
In a shocker. Yeah.
Okay,
I don't know why.
They do tend to do that with this category.
Yeah, this category is always kind of the wild card. So, I don't know, playing a hunch.
I can't see that because I saw American Gangster. I more or less liked it. I like Ruby Dee a lot. I kind of forgot she was in this movie.
Yeah, me too.
Within a week of seeing it.
Yeah, I do remember her slapping Denzel. I think that's about it. But I think we're with you. We both liked, more or less, American Gangster. Ruby Dee is a legend, though. I do think that in terms of who will win, I think it's down between Amy Ryan and Cate Blanchett, and we loved Cate Blanchett, Maddie. I think we're both going with her for the should win.
Yep.
What about you, Keith?
I think she's fantastic. I think Amy Ryan is a real force in a role that could have receded into the background in that movie. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of hers. I think she will win, and I think she should win.
Yeah, and actually, I do want to be clear. I do think Amy Ryan is actually going to win. I think it's going to be tough between her and Blanchett, but they do like to go with the Marissa Tomei's and the Mercedes Ruehl's and those kind of people. They like to shock you with this category. I think Amy Ryan, again, not a shocker. She's been winning some awards, but maybe not the heavyweight that Blanchett or Ruby Dee.
Who's Mercedes Ruehl?
For The Fisher King.
Oh, you mean Mercedes Ruehl?
If you want to correct me on that, Maddie. Let's move on then to Best Actor. The nominees: George Clooney and Michael Clayton, Daniel Day-Lewis and There Will Be Blood, Johnny Depp and Sweeney Todd, Tommy Lee Jones, The Valley of Ella, and Viggo Mortensen in Eastern Promises. Maddie, where are you falling on this one?
Well, I think Daniel Day-Lewis is going to win it, and I would like to see it go to Tommy Lee Jones or Viggo Mortensen, actually.
You did have Viggo in your top five. What about you, Keith?
I think it's Daniel Day-Lewis and everybody else this year. I mean, that's sort of a performance to study for decades, and I think he will and should win.
Yeah, I do think he's a lock to win that one. In terms of who should win, I would go with Daniel Day-Lewis, despite the fact that I was critical of him during our review. I think he gets a little too ham-bone at the end. I think he could have been a little more subtle with that character, and it would have been more interesting. But I'm a big fan of all these performances, really. Clooney, I think, is solid. I like all the other ones, but I do think that with Daniel Day-Lewis, he has created a character that is absolutely mythic. I think he's larger than life. And so whether he's great in the last 15 or 20 minutes or not, he deserves the Academy Award. Best Actress, then: Cate Blanchett in Elizabeth the Golden Age, Julie Christie in Away from Her, Marion Cotillard in La Vie en Rose, Laura Linney from The Savages, and Ellen Page in Juno. And we should note, there are a couple of films that we all haven't seen from this list of nominees. For you, Maddie, actually, in this category, La Vie en Rose and Elizabeth, you haven't had a chance to catch up with yet?
I haven't seen Elizabeth. I've seen La Vie en Rose.
Okay, and I also recently was able to catch up with La Vie en Rose. For you, then, the only one is La Vie en Rose. You saw Elizabeth.
It is. I did see Elizabeth the Golden Age. I can talk about that a little bit because I was shocked by this nomination. I love Cate Blanchett.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's a great actress. This is a terrible movie.
That's what everyone
says. As someone who was not a fan of the first one, this was disappointing by those standards, and she's not good in it. It's not even in any way saved by her presence.
Really? So in terms of who will win and who should win, where would you go in this category?
I would go – I think it's going to be Ellen Page. I think it's going to be the, sort of the best supporting actress. Shocker is going to be moved up to the best actress this year. And I think the goodwill of that performance in that movie are going to be overwhelming.
Maddie?
Yeah, I'm torn. I think it's going to be Ellen Page, but I'm not sure. It could be Julie Christie. It's sort of a coin flip for me, but I think who should win is Marion Cotillard.
Really?
I really do.
Ellen Page was your number one performance of the
year,
though.
But I think Marion Cotillard in this film really carries it. I don't really love the film,
but she is
fantastic.
She really is good, and it would be fitting that if Daniel Day-Lewis wins, that she should win because she's the only Best Actress nominee that has that same level of sort of histrionics in the movie and really carrying the movie. It's a huge performance, just like Plainview is in There Will Be Blood. So I wouldn't be surprised if she won or if it did end up going to Julie Christie again, that kind of lifetime achievement. She's a legend.
She's not even the best actor in that film. Gordon Pinson is so beautiful.
I agree. And he really got snubbed here. I'm with you. I think Ellen Page is going to be the shocker here. I think this is where Juno ends up being the surprise, not in the best picture category. And I would still give it to Ellen Page, even though I agree Marion Cotillard is really good. Best director then, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, of course, Julian Schnabel. From Juno, Jason Reitman, Tony Gilroy for Michael Clayton, the Coen brothers for No Country for Old Men, and Paul Thomas Anderson, There Will Be Blood. Maddie?
I think it's going to the Coen brothers, and I think it should go to the Coen brothers.
Keith?
I think it might go to the Coen brothers as well. I think from here on up, it's sort of a toss-up between There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men on both the should and the will, in terms of on my list anyway.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say Paul Thomas Anderson just to be contentious.
Okay. Interesting. I do think he's got a shot, but yeah, I'm giving this one to Joel Coen and Ethan Coen, and I do hope they win as well. Best Picture then, Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood. No Country was in your top three of the year, your second favorite film of the year?
Yeah.
And it was my favorite film of the year, so obviously it sounds like we're going that direction, Maddie.
Yes, but I think that There Will Be Blood will win.
You do?
I don't know why. I'm back in a long
You have
shot.
A feeling that just it's this epic American film that maybe it's going to get recognized.
Yeah, I really do. I think it's got a lot of great word of mouth going on for it, so I think it might win.
Keith?
If either of them wins, I'll be very happy, and I think one of them will win. I think it's going to be No Country for Old Men, but either one, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah.
It's a really good year for films last year, and there aren't – even my second and third choices here are very satisfying.
Well, and I actually did want to close out
the
segment.
As long as it doesn't go to Atonement, I'm happy.
Well, and see, I loved Atonement, so that wouldn't bother me, but I did want to close the segment by mentioning the – quality of the films that got Best Picture nominees this year, because I think it may be the best crop of Best Picture nominees since the 70s. Go back to 74 or maybe 76, of course, when you had All the President's Men and Taxi Driver and Network and some of those films. And I mentioned Scott Tobias earlier. He told me when he was putting together his list of the top 10 films of the year that he had three movies on that list, including No Country, There Will Be Blood, and then Zodiac, which I agree with him, got snubbed here. I would like to see it in there. Those are three movies that for him are maybe three of the best films of the past 10 years. And I think he's probably right. And then here, two of them got Best Picture nominations. I mean, obviously that speaks to the quality of films this year, doesn't it?
I think so, too. There's no, like, sort of Rocky or Ordinary People that's going to upset. I mean, they're not – I think I like those movies just fine.
Sure.
But they're not sort of the – all-time great movies. There's no Raging Bull upset or Goodfellas upset.
Okay. We will get into a little bit more of our Oscar discussion here in the next segment before we get into the top five.
Time for one last quick break. Up next, put the children to bed. Break open the oysters and the asparagus. It's time for our top five love scenes. And yes, I will do the entire segment in this voice. Stay with us.
You've been gone too long. Where can you be? They said 3 months, you'd come for me. I shouted.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
A lot of films, Maddie, coming out this Tuesday that we have reviewed this year on Film Spotting. A lot of recent 2007 stuff. American Gangster Out includes a commentary with Ridley Scott and the writer Steven Zaillian. In the Valley of Ella, the Paul Haggis film. Lust, Caution, Margot at the Wedding, Michael Clayton. It includes an audio commentary by the writer-director Tony Gilroy and his editor John Gilroy, redacted the Brian De Palma film that I have ripped on profusely on this show. That has a director's commentary, and Terror's Advocate is out, a documentary that is about the lawyer who defends a lot of these notorious dictators from around the world, a movie we haven't seen, but one I'm curious to check out. And Pierre Le Fou, a classic from Jean-Luc Godard. It's a Criterion Collection edition of that bunch, Maddie. I think there's a lot in there that falls into the either didn't work at all category for us, like Margot, mm-hmm. Redacted, Rendition. But then everything else, the others are all kind of films that, you know, are worth checking out.
Well, definitely want to check out Michael Clayton in anticipation of the Oscars. Mm-hmm. But Lust Caution, definitely.
It's worth seeing.
I think I'm really curious to revisit this because I think I'm going to like it more the second time.
When you weren't seeing it in Toronto in your harried state.
Yeah,
maybe,
exactly.
A little bit. And American Gangster is definitely worth checking out.
Oh, very much so.
As well. All the movies we mentioned in this segment can be purchased at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Just click on the Film Spotting movie store link at filmspotting.net. And we want to mention that right now they have a buy two, get one free sale going on. That applies if you enter through the Film Spotting movie store. So check them out at TLAvideo.com.
Okay, well, right now we want to take a little bit of time and thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net and donated a couple of their hard-earned dollars our way. We, of course, are humbled by each and every donation. It plays a huge part in making this show possible week after week. And in gratitude, here are your patented film spotting nicknames. We have a lot of them this week. Daniel, founding member of the Church of Isadora Duncan. Peter, groundball fascism. Keith, player to be named later. Stephanie, thinking classy. That's a Silver Club donor. Lamar, cursed with self-awareness. Martin, excuse me while I howl at the moon. Another Silver Club donor. Eric, trying not to think. Andrew, respect the streak. Sean, dazzle me, a Gold Club donor. Craig, learning my cliches. Dana, a question of quantum physics. Kyle, high fiber and good scotch. Leslie, the sweet spot. Kevin, sometimes you lose, sometimes it rains. Patrick, mama's favorite lollygagger. Matt, stable pony to the stars. Alyssa, long legs and brains. That's a Gold Club member. Michelle, pissing away a Hall of Fame arm. Tom, live rooster, and Benjamin, announcing my presence with authority, another Silver Club donor.
We do appreciate each and every donation. We also do need to single out there Lamar Lofton, cursed with self-awareness, Lamar. That was a gift on behalf of his friend Amber, so we appreciate that. And the theme, of course, this week that Sam is using for the nicknames, Maddie, is Bull Durham. I'm really shocked you didn't get the references there to Bull Durham. Lollygagger, long legs, and brains. All great references there by Sam.
Oh, Live Rooster.
The Live Rooster, of course, to take away the Hex. Some good stuff there from Sam. We also want to mention that nicknames, we've talked about this earlier, this aspect of the show.
They're going away.
They're going away. It's going to come to an end on episode 200. I think that show is going to air on February 29th. Sam will be here on the show. He's going to give that last batch of nicknames. So if you want one before it goes away, you have to get it in. Actually, I think the date we're going to try and do that show may be around the 22nd of February or the 24th of February. So get your donation in by then if you want a Sam Van Halgren nickname.
Now, in lieu of nicknames, we do have a contingency plan in place. Am I correct?
We do, actually, and I'm very excited about it. I know you are, too. Many listeners in our message boards are excited. We've talked about it with them, and that is you're going to actually get to influence a little bit what happens here on Film Spotting. We're still going to thank you on the show by name and on our website, filmspotting.net.
And if you have any messages, please send them in.
Go ahead and send them in. We will mention them on the show. But we do have a little new format idea in mind, and that is for every $10 you donate, you're going to get an extra name in the hat. You're going to get your name in a hat, and we're going to pick out a winner once a month, and we're going to do a thing called Listener's Choice in lieu of our marathon, where you're actually going to get to send us, if you're chosen as the winner, a list of three movies you want to hear us talk about. We're going to pick one and review it on the show. And maybe some people are thinking, well, that sounds kind of odd, but actually, over the last 3 years, and even this week, we receive many. We get emails all the time from people saying, I love this movie. I'd love to hear you guys talk about it, you know, some DVD that's out. Well, now's your chance to hear us talk about it by donating to the show. And again, supporting the show, it really does
we'll
go a long way.
We'll see how it goes. It sounds very convoluted.
It is kind of convoluted, but we'll see. And we may also throw in some swag as well.
Oh, yes. They will be entered for their chance to win a Film Spotting fun pack.
A fun pack.
We don't know what that is.
We don't know what that is, but we will come up with it. And we do have to mention our swag. We mentioned it once like 4 weeks ago and haven't been back. But at filmspotting.net, you can click on our Cafe Press store if you're interested in getting a Film Spotting t-shirt or hat. Or even a onesie if you have a new infant at home. So check that out at filmspotting.net.
Please don't wear your onesie to work anymore, Adam.
I'm a desperate girl that terrifies me.
Can you
You're listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and we are joined for another segment by Keith Phipps, the editor from the AV Club. We're going to get into our top five love scenes here in a moment in honor of Valentine's Day, but we did want to just close out the Oscar discussion a little bit. Best original screenplay and best adapted screenplay. In the original screenplay category, the nominees are Juno, Lars and the Real Girl, Michael Clayton, Ratatouille, and The Savages. Full disclosure, I don't think any of us have seen Lars and the Real Girl. We have seen the other four nominees. Is this one pretty much a given that it goes to Diablo Cody for Juno?
Got to be Juno.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Diablo Cody for Juno.
And would you say that she deserves to win from these nominees?
That's tough. I really liked Juno. I know there's a huge backlash against it. I mean, it is very it's very written, and I almost kind of like the one. It's almost too obvious to give that award to one where every you can almost see the screenplay as you watch it. But because I think the sort of the nonverbal aspects of the screenplay writing tend to get overlooked in this category. But sure, Juno, I liked it.
Yeah, I would say it's my favorite film of those nominees, and so I think she is a lock for it. I would like to see that. Best adapted screenplay: Atonement, Away from Her, The Diving Bell, and The Butterfly, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood. Anybody jump out here who you think is going to win this category?
No Country for Old Men, and I think it should too. I mean, I think not to backtrack, but that's a case where there's not a lot of dialogue to work with in the first place, and they bring it to life in a really interesting way.
Mm-hmm. And the one that doesn't really belong there is There Will Be Blood. I mean, it is only very, very loosely
lifted from
based
other materials
on oil.
And Upton Sinclair.
Bear in mind also that O Brother, Where Art Thou was adapted screenplay.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Which makes no sense at all.
Some strict definitions there.
Yeah. I do think No Country is going to win, and it would be my pick. And I would put it on my list. I know this is maybe heresy a little bit because Cormac McCarthy is so revered and rightfully so, but I think it would go on my list of movies that actually exceed the source material. I just finally finished reading No Country for Old Men, the book, and it's great, but a lot of the dialogue, the Coen brothers, I think, do it a little bit better, and the things
reworked. I'm not a Cormac McCarthy fan, really. I think he's pretty overrated.
Well, I think the book's fantastic, but I actually think the changes the Coen brothers make do improve the source material, so I would go there. Just a couple things I wanted to mention real quick that I would like to see. Achievement in Music, written for motion pictures, otherwise known as Original Song. I really hope it goes to Falling Slowly from Once, of course. I was a huge fan of that film. And Achievement in Cinematography, another example where they absolutely got it right, I think, in terms of the five
sort
nominees.
Sort of the 1927 Yankees lineup.
Yeah,
there.
It is. Roger Deakins twice for The Assassination of Jesse James and for No Country for Old Men. Seamus McGarvey for Atonement. The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Janusz Kaminski there, and Robert Elswit for There Will Be Blood. All five deserving of the nomination. I do hope Roger Deakins wins, and I hope it's for No Country, but I'd love to see any of those guys win.
And you could do Elswit twice this year, too. Michael Clayton's a really gorgeously shot film as well.
And Roger Deakins also did In the Valley of Ella, which I think he did some good work in, though it isn't really up there with these other films.
I would like to see Transformers win in sound mixing, and I'm actually being 100%
really?
Serious.
Even though you hated that film?
Yeah, but the one thing that I remember is that sound of those cars transforming. I left the theater
That's
thinking that was really cool.
That's worthy of a statuette for you?
Why not?
Okay, well, that closes out our Oscar talk. We now want to get into the Valentine's spirit here a little bit, I guess, and get into our top five love scenes. Of course, by love scenes, we mean top five sex scenes. Maddie, get us started. What's your number five?
All right, well, my number five is Team America World Police. I don't love the entire film, but the love scene, I think, is sort of the king of the sex scene parodies. And I love the story that Matt Stone and Trey Parker, they basically, they knew the MPAA would never allow most of the scene to go, so they went even further, just so that they could keep some of it.
Yeah.
I love that scene.
A great choice. Keith, what about you?
I think for number five, I have to get a little conceptual, and it really may only apply to males of our age, but it's that first movie you see at Cinemax on a Friday night that really actually has a sexy scene.
Are you going with Shannon Tweed?
Before that, but like in the 80s when they would show like 70s softcore stuff.
Okay.
And it was nice. It was a good. And I think mine would actually be a film called Felicity. I believe it was an Australian film.
Really, that's the one that stands out for you from your adolescence.
I remember that one very well. Well, it brought me into adolescence, I believe.
Well, I do have to point out that I'm calling this my Last Tango in Paris memorial list, and I have a disclaimer as well. That I have to note what my wife Sarah said. I was telling her about this list, and she said, "Of course, it's just like two guys to talk about sex scenes in honor of Valentine's Day, not go with something more romantic." And I do want to point out that we've already done our top five date movies here on the show. We've already done Forbidden Love, so I didn't see an obvious, more romantic fit. We thought love scenes would be fun to do. Of course, Sarah then pointed out we could have done best kiss, which she's right, maybe a little more sweet and innocent, but we're sticking with love scenes. And for me, my criterion was simple. It had to be a case where the sex scene had to be one of the top two or three things I thought of instantly when I thought about this film. And for me, I'm going with A History of Violence. I know, Maddie, you're not a big fan of that movie. The David Cronenberg film. There's really two scenes that I don't think you can separate from each other in that film, of course. The Viggo Mortensen and Maria Bello, where they're kind of the corny married couple. No kids around. They're doing a little role playing. She's wearing her old cheerleader outfit. And I think it's great because all the themes of the movie are right there in that scene. The fact that they don't really know about each other's past all that much, and yet they feel really comfortable with each other, obviously. And the way they slip into their positions, I think, is so natural, and I just think it's a great scene. Then, of course, later we get the great violent outburst, the animalistic sex scene on the stairs where Maria Bello realizes that she really doesn't know her husband at all, and she's repulsed by that and turned on at the same time. Great stuff.
Oh, man. I'm so weirded out right now hearing you describe positions.
Yeah. Well, I did cough before it. Didn't that make the irony?
All right, moving
on.
My number four, Lust Caution, 2007.
Really?
Ang Lee. Oh, yeah, because I think the love scenes are probably the best scenes from the film because they're just sort of this amalgamation of incongruity. They want to kill each other, yet they still want to make love. And, of course, there's some of the most acrobatic scenes you've ever seen, and they're feral and visceral. I really liked it.
My only qualification there, is there one scene in particular that stands out, or one or two, or do you just kind of meld all those scenes together?
I thought they were all pretty good.
Okay. Keith, what about you? Your number four.
My number four is, I'm going to go with Wild at Heart, David Lynch's 1990 film, and not one scene in particular, but just the sexual chemistry between Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern in that movie is pretty incredible. And the sex is explicit, but it also kind of tells you something about these characters, where every sort of gesture matters and registers on both their faces, and it's sexy and also tells you something about the film as well.
Yeah, it's a great pick, and I'm actually sticking with David Lynch for my number four. I'm going with Mulholland Drive, the scene between Laura Elena Herring and Naomi Watts, where they're comforting each other after a trying day, and I would love nothing more here than to come up with some artful explanation for why this is on my list. And I suppose I do genuinely like the innocence of it all. I find it touching in some way. But the fact is, the scene speaks for itself. I've got nothing intelligent to say here. You knew in a David Lynch movie that it was only a matter of time before one or both of our heroines ended up taking at least their tops off. And then here, Lynch takes them the extra step. And I actually remember reading that Lynch didn't want chapters on the DVD for right. Mulholland Drive because he didn't want people to skip right to the sex scene on the disc. And no, I have no idea why he would think that would happen or why I would be looking for an explanation about the absence of chapters on the DVD. I don't have an explanation for that, but it is my number four.
Okay, well, my number three is Sex and Lucia. Sort of it's a nebulous of a little Spanish movie, one of those, you know, where the stories sort of flit in and out of reality. But what I really like about the sex scenes is that they sort of capture, you know, the giddiness and the playfulness of the beginning of a fledgling relationship. I really like that.
Keith, what about you? Your number three.
Number three, sort of a random scene from an only okay movie, but it's the adaptation of Name of the Rose. The quickness, if you recall the scene, Christian Slater is a young monk who's sort of mounted out of the blue by a peasant girl who had previously been trading sexual favors for an old, broken-down person, and who sexual need kind of explodes in a very memorable moment.
Yeah, a great pick there. My number three, Maddie, is your number five, Team America World Police, a movie I do think is just absolutely hilarious. And sure, there's the whole subversive aspect of it and maybe what they're trying to get away with the MPAA by having these marionettes in this sex scene do things that you could never see any people do on screen. But the fact is, for me, it's just one of the funniest laugh-out-loud scenes maybe ever. And funny, I think, in that childish way where when you're watching it, you feel like you're doing something naughty, like an adult's going to come in any minute and say, "What the hell are you watching?" and tell you to close your eyes. And so I love that aspect of it. I think it's just hilarious. So my number three then, Maddie, your number two.
My number two, Tom Cruise, Rebecca De Mornay, and a train. Risky Business.
Yeah.
I love that scene.
Yeah, it's good. And one I certainly thought may come up here on our list. What about you, Keith?
I have Betty Blue, the opening scene for Betty Blue. Not a great movie, but a very memorable sex scene performed underneath a reproduction of the Mona Lisa for that artistic touch.
All right. Well, my number two, let's go ahead and hear a scene.
So she did help you.
I don't think we should get into that.
You're right. And I won't ask about Buddy or what you guys are doing in Detroit or if you've run into Glenn Michaels yet or...
Okay, now don't talk like that because you scare me.
That is George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez in Steven Soderbergh's film Out of Sight.
Oh, great pick. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah,
oh,
a movie pick. I love, a scene I love, the cross-cutting between the prelude to the consummation of their forbidden attraction and then later the actual act itself. And I don't think it's titillating in any way, but it's really sexy.
Well, I actually think it's very titillating without being gratuitous. Yeah. I love that. No nudity.
Well, I just think it's sexy, I think, is the way I would describe it. And you've got the snow falling, David Holmes' great score, which you heard there. And then I really love the playfulness of the way they interact with each other, where they're getting their chance to forget for a little bit who they really are and the fact that, you know, he's a thief, she's a cop, and they shouldn't be doing this. I also love the little hiccups in the editing. That's a little device that Soderbergh there uses throughout the whole film. I think the freeze frames are actually in perfect rhythm with the music, and I think that's a nice touch. So Out of Sight is my number two, which brings us finally to our number one picks for our favorite sex scenes in movies, Maddie Ballgame.
Well, the 1980s did one thing really, really well, and that's sleazy thrillers. And I think the best of them all was Body Heat. So you've got William Hurt, you got Kathleen Turner in full vamp mode, and of course you have the very famous scene that's parodied a lot. You know, William Hurt has just been turned away. He looks back through the glass, through the chimes, and he sees Kathleen Turner inside, and he picks up a chair, and he breaks the window to get to her. Good stuff.
All right, Body Heat, another one I thought would come up here. Keith?
My number one is one that I can't believe everyone else failed to mention. It's kind of the prequel to your Out of Sight scene, which is the scene from Don't Look Now. Nicholas Roeg's sort of bizarre, unsettling, ultimately kind of silly, but still great horror thriller set in Venice with Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland. Donald Sutherland, maybe no one's first choice for a sex symbol, but this is very wonderful love scene between the two of them that kind of cross-cuts between the act itself and the aftermath, and it's a very comfortable lived-in married sex scene, very comfortable lived-in married sex, and it's both like familiar and erotic at the same time, and it's a great scene.
I absolutely agree. In fact, I agree so much. It's my number one. Don't Look Now is on my list. It was actually the first scene that popped into my head when we came up with this idea for this list, and it is the scene that inspired Soderbergh very directly for Out of Sight, my number two. And you have Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland in that scene. They've earlier lost a daughter in an accident, and it's them getting together for a little bit of afternoon fun, just kind of a lazy afternoon. They're getting ready to go out, and so you see the cross-cutting between the actual sex scene and then them getting ready to go out for dinner later that night. And I do think there's some great editing there where you got these kind of great visual matches between what they're doing in each instance. But it's actually a pretty hot sex scene, even with Donald Sutherland in it, and one that I have to admit I feel like a bit of a voyeur whenever I see it. I mean, there's nothing really conventional about the scene, of course. The nature of the sex, it's like A History of Violence in that it seems very natural and like you're being given kind of access to something between two couples, lived-in, married sex, like you called it. You feel like you're seeing something really intimate these two people are sharing.
They're so
and
natural.
It should only be between them.
Yeah, they're so natural and they're so coupley. It's almost like when you see a couple playing together that you know are a couple in real life, where it's sort of uncomfortable to see them acting
exactly
like a couple. Not that they were together at the time, but it's that good.
It is
convincing.
It is absolutely fantastic. That's my number one.
And I haven't seen it. It is now number one on my Netflix queue.
Okay.
All right, well, those are our top five love scenes in honor of Valentine's Day. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, Doug Liman's new film, Jumper, Definitely Maybe, with Ryan Reynolds, The Spiderwick Chronicles, and Step Up to the Streets, which I believe is also called The Maddie Robinson Story. On next week's show, we'll discuss Jumper. We're not 100% sure that we're going to talk about Definitely Maybe. I've heard just terrible things about it, but Maddie, for some reason, you're dying to see it.
No, it's Valentine's Day. It's
a romantic comedy.
Basically, I want to get your wife out of the house. I want you to take her to a film.
You want to take her to the movie?
I'm saving your marriage.
I appreciate that. We will also get to the final movie in our Bergman Marathon, Fanny and Alexander, and we're going to do our top five actors we wouldn't cast in our movie.
Okay, well, thanks as always to our listener volunteers, Alex, Angela, Frank, and Candace. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to the Rosebuds and Merge Records for this week's music. Learn more at mergerecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I, of course, want to say thank you as well to Keith Phipps from the AV Club. You can learn more at avclub.com, the wonderful entertainment section of The Onion. It's really indispensable. It was great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net.
fucking Bruges.
In fucking Bruges. let's do something real quick. Uh-huh. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But start it and a brief review of last year's Palme d'Or winner.
Okay. And a brief review of last year's Palme d'Or winner at the Cannes Film Festival, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
What's more romantic than abortion? But first, a little sightseeing.
I don't think so. That can be for the podcast only version.
Well, there you go.
I like it. I like how edgy you are. I think in honor of Martin McDonagh. I like that.
Let's see here.
Oh, Jesus.
I thought you were going to let me roll with it. I guess not.
Okay. Oh, man.
That's fine. Okay, I'm ready.